last episode, we proved the exact recovery theorem, which gives a sufficient condition for the orthogonal matching pursuit algorithm to identify the support of a sparse vector after m iterations. And that's this ugly looking thing. And as people asked me during the interval, how do you know omega? How do you calculate this? And the right question to ask. This theorem is not very useful without a method for figuring out how big that thing is. And so the next result gives a way to estimate how big that quantity on the left side of the exact recovery condition is in terms of the size of the set omega and properties of the dictionary. Okay, so you don't have to figure out what that set is, which would mean you'd already solved the problem and you wouldn't need the algorithm, you could just go home. So, and the bounds are going to be in terms of the coherence parameter that we mentioned before that gives you the maximum correlation between columns of the dictionary. So we do not know omega, but we can estimate the left-hand side of the condition in terms of the size of omega, which we've called m, and in terms of mu, the coherence of the dictionary. Okay, so here's how this works. The condition, ERC, holds whenever m is less than or equal to, it's actually strictly less than 1/2 mu inverse plus 1. So what this tells us is that by combining this theorem and the last theorem, OMP can recover any signal that is sufficiently sparse. For all vectors x. And the level of sparsity is given by this bound here. So we need the sparsity of the vector to be smaller than 1/2 the reciprocal of the coherence plus 1. And so this bound looks something like m less than or equal to 1/2 square root d plus 1 for the Dirac Fourier dictionary. Okay, so what this tells you is that up to the square root of the dimension, you can recover, in a space of dimension D, you can recover signals that are sparse, provided the sparsity is less than about 1/2 the square root of the ambient dimension. You can actually improve this a little in the Dirac Fourier case, but not substantially. And it's basically the difference between a factor of 1/2 and something like 0.9.
Is there a connection between that formula and randomness?
Yeah, you need randomness if you want to do better. This is sufficient but not necessary.
We can actually not do measure because here is a lower bound.
That's right. Yeah. And in fact, because we know that mu is likely to be at least 1 over root d, this is really as good as the condition is going to get for most cases. So it's basically the best qualitative behavior you can expect from this result. For a general dictionary. We'll talk about the random case at the end. Okay, so here's the proof. So We assume that the size of omega is equal to m, and we'll start calculating it. So we need the maximum over the bad columns of this pseudo inverse applied to vector phi k. Take the one norm. And so the first thing we'll do is write out the definition of the pseudo inverse. And so that's phi omega transpose phi omega inverse phi omega transpose phi k. Okay, remember that we said that because omega is a sparsest representation, the vectors listed in omega are linearly independent. So this matrix here is got full column rank. And so this matrix here is invertible. Okay? So you're allowed to write this down. Okay, first thing we're going to do is apply this operator norm bound to break this into two pieces. This piece here, which is inner products between good atoms and a bad atom, and this thing here, which is just the inverse of some matrix. So the operator norm bound gives the L1 norm this matrix times the maximum over columns that are not an omega of center products. Okay, so this is just the operator norm bound. And we'll estimate these one after the next, starting with the one on the right. So this term here can also be written as the maximum over k not belonging to omega of the sum of the inner products between sum over the columns in omega. Alright, I'll say those in English now. Okay. So we're going to fix a k that does not belong to the good set. So we're going to fix a bad atom. And then we're going to compute the inner products with all the good atoms. That's what this vector is, the inner product between the bad atom and the good atoms. And then we're going to take the one norm of that vector. So we're going to take the absolute values of those inner products and add them up. So this is just rewriting this expression. We haven't done anything. Now, because j is never equal to k, because j is an omega, k is not an omega, this is never bigger than mu, the coherence. How many terms are in the sum? M. So this is less than m times mu. That was easy. Okay. Any questions on that? So, real easy bound for the second part. The first part's a little bit harder. So what we're going to do now is have a look at that matrix. So phi omega transpose phi omega has got ones down the diagonal because they're the inner products, the diagonal entries are the norms of the columns of this matrix. They're all one. The Euclidean norm of each column is one, so we have ones down the diagonal, and then we have some other stuff out here. So we can write this matrix as I minus A, where A is the off-diagonal part. Okay? And so the entries of A are inner products between distinct atoms. And it's got a zero diagonal. Okay? So what that tells us is that the L1 operator norm of A, which is the maximum L1 norm of a column, is less than or equal to mu, because the entries of A are inner products, none of them are bigger than mu, and each column of A has at most m minus 1, which is an m by m matrix, so A has no more than m minus 1 column, non-zeros per column, each one's no bigger than mu, so we have this bound on the L1 operator norm. Any questions on that? Okay. So now that we've done this, we're ready to estimate the size of B. And so what we'll do is we'll write out this matrix here as I minus A, and the inverse of I minus A is given by a Neumann series. So we can sum from S equals 0 to infinity the matrix A raised to the S power. So this is something that is a natural analog of a geometric series. Okay, so you can think about 1 over 1 minus a number A can be written as the sum of, is this infinite sum? So it's like the sum of a geometric series, and it converges in the cases that we're interested in, so don't worry about that. And now what we'll do is we'll pull the norm inside the sum and use the fact that this is a matrix norm, so it's submultiplicative, hard to say. All right, so here's what we get. Sum from S equals 0 to infinity of the norm of A raised to the S power. Okay. So we just pulled the norm inside the sum, and then we've pulled it inside the power. Okay. Now this is a geometric series with ratio norm A, which is the 1 norm. And so the sum is equal to 1 minus the 1 norm of A. We know what that is, we just calculated it. So it's 1 over 1 minus m minus 1 times mu. Okay. So we write the matrix in this form, we use a Neumann series to compute its inverse, we make some estimates, pull the norm inside, and then sum the geometric series, and then remember how big the 1 norm of A is. So that's the entire process here. And that gives us an estimate here for the quantity of interest. It's less than or equal to m times mu over 1 minus m minus 1 times mu. And we need this to be less than 1. Because we want this condition here to hold. Okay? So, now we just have to do a microscopic amount of algebra. We'll finish. So, it suffices that m mu plus m minus 1 mu is less than 1 by multiplying through and then moving this term to the left. And that's the same as m being less than half mu inverse plus 1. So, let me come all the way back here to this left board and remind you what we just did. So this condition here ensures that orthogonal matching pursuit recovers a signal whose sparsest representation contains the atoms listed in omega. And it turns out that that condition holds whenever the size of omega, the number of atoms, is not too big, where not too big is this number here. We can calculate this. It's not real hard to find all the interproducts between the atoms and take their maximum. So this actually gives you a bound that you can calculate, and it tells you that orthogonal matching pursuit can recover every signal that has a sufficiently sparse representation. Okay. So that's the punchline. Orthogonal matching pursuit works if the signal is sparse enough. And the sparsity depends on this number here, which tells you something about the geometry of the dictionary. All right. Now,
you mean orthogonal matching pursuit will not fail?
That's right.
If it's sparse enough.
That's right. Will not fail. It's possible that bound is m equals 0, but A few people asked me about what happens if the signal is not exactly sparse. And so there is an analogous result that holds in that case. So the proof is actually not that much different from this. I'll just write down the statement, and we can leave it at that. So the sparsity constrained problem. So here's the result. So let's assume now that the number m is less than or equal to 1/3 mu inverse, so a little bit smaller than before. For any vector x, the approximation A sub m after m steps of OMP satisfies the following bound. So the L2 error in the approximation that we calculate is smaller than 1 plus 6 times m times x minus A opt. So A opt is an optimal m term approximation of x. Okay? So what this tells you is that the result given by the algorithm is not too much worse in the error than the best approximation. That's true for every vector. Okay. So before we assume that x had a sparse representation. Now, we don't assume that anymore. We just say that if this is the best sparse approximation using m columns of the dictionary, we obtain a result with m columns that's whose error is within a factor.
Okay. Is that sigma or six?
This is six. I'm sorry. Yeah. So the six is connected to the 1/3, actually, in a slightly complicated way. I pick 1/3 because it makes the number look nice. If you make the bound smaller, you get a smaller number, but you're still stuck with that m there. Okay. So this is what happens when there's noise. And so this starts to tell you about the performance of orthogonal matching and pursuit and actually getting at sparse vectors over general dictionaries. Yeah. Yeah, I do. I was being modest. The reference for most of what I've talked about is a paper I wrote called Greed is Good. It's on my webpage, and it was published in Information Theory a few years ago. Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about compressed sensing because that's one of the major problems that people are interested in this these days, and it's probably one of the motivations that many of you have for coming to this workshop. So, lecture three. LMP and compressed sensing. So I'm going to give you an introduction to compressed sensing, and I'm going to compare these coherence results I just presented with what you would like, and then I'll give you a result for how orthogonal matching pursuit performs for the compressed sensing problem. I'm not going to prove that result, which because we don't have time, and that's probably good for all of us. Okay, so here's the signal recovery problem. So the letters are going to change just a little bit, so be careful. Suppose x belongs to Rn, vector with m non-zero entries. And the idea here is that m is much smaller than n. So we think about x as being some big n-dimensional vector, and it doesn't have many non-zero entries. Okay? So we're going to acquire information about x by performing linear measurements. I'll tell you what that means. So we acquire information about x by computing linear measurements, and we can make a list of the measurements. So the first one is the inner product with a vector v1. This is a linear measurement. Second one is the inner product with a vector v2. It's the next measurement. And we do that d times. So inner product between these d vectors. And we're going to assume that the vectors here are independent of x. So we have this collection of measurement vectors here. They're also in Rn. And we'll collect information about x by computing the inner product between x and these vectors. And the vectors cannot depend on n. So this is a non-adaptive process. Okay. And our goal is to reconstruct x. Given the measurements. All right. So let me show you how this connects with what we've been talking about before. It turns out this is also a sparse representation problem. So we form a matrix phi by making the vectors the rows of this matrix. So now the V's are set out like this, and that this is, a D by N matrix. So I'm keeping the same letters for the dimensions of the matrix. Okay? And we'll also view this as a column matrix, and we'll give the columns the same name as before, V1, V2, up to Vn. Still D by N, and these guys are columns now. Okay? So we compute measurements of x by taking inner products with the rows of this matrix. And we're also going to want to think about the columns of the matrix, and so we're going to call those phi, just like we did before. And so we can view the measurements as a vector y given by multiplying x into phi. Okay. Actually, let me put transposes on these to make this a little bit clearer. So we multiply x into phi, and then we get a vector of the inner product between x and the rows of this matrix. Okay, so remember, x is sparse. Reconstruction can be viewed as a sparse representation problem. So, in short, we want an estimate of x by finding the sparsest vector z that gives us the same measurements as x did. Okay? So we've got this vector of measurements here. So we've got hold of this. We've got hold of the matrix phi, and we want to estimate what x gave rise to those measurements. So we're going to sift through all of the vectors that can give rise to those measurements, and we're going to look for the sparsest one. Okay? So sparse representation problem. And once again, we can use orthogonal matching pursuit to solve it. Now, the first question to ask is how many measurements you need to do this. So, no more than n, because we could just take x, compute all the inner products with the standard basis, and we can write down x again. Okay? That's kind of dumb, though. And the reason is that, let's say we knew where the locations of the non-zeros were. Then, the m non-zeros take at least m measurements to identify. So this is actually a lower bound. You can never do better than m if the vector's got m non-zeros. Okay, you've got to measure those locations. But that depends on us knowing the locations. Okay, so these are sort of the two extremes. If you're going to do something really stupid, just measure on the standard basis, that takes n measurements and is big. If we knew the location of the non-zeros, we could just measure the vector in those locations. That's m measurements. Now, let me try to motivate how many you really need. So for binary, that is 0, 1 vectors that are m sparse, you need, well, how many of these things are there? So you've got n components. You pick m of them to be equal to 1. There are n choose m of them. And so it takes log base 2 of n choose m bits. Ceiling. To tell these things apart. Just by the pigeonhole principle. They're n choose m of the vectors. To tell each one apart, you need a different label. You can write down the labels using log 2. Of that number of bits. And by Stirling's approximation, this is m times log n over m with a constant in front and a trailing term. Okay? So what it looks like is that you really need the number of measurements is proportional to the sparsity level and logarithmic in the length of the signal. M is the sparsity level, N is the signal length. And so this is sort of an intuition for why this is the right number of bits. Okay? Things are a little different because we're using real value measurements, but don't worry about that. And so we're going to see that in fact, with orthogonal matching pursuit, about M log N measurements are enough. So the point here is that if you know your vector is sparse, you can take exponentially fewer measurements of it and still reconstruct it than you could if you didn't know anything about it. All right. So what do you think? How do you do this? What kind of measurements do you need? Sort of a subtlety that I don't think has been properly addressed in the literature yet. Just a little bit of that. Those are, you can't actually do that with linear measurements in any way. you have enough bits, you can do anything, you know. Half a measurement.
Yeah.
Tenth of a measurement. All right. Anyway, so I'm just trying to motivate that really, if you're looking at things in terms of bits, the right number of measurements is something like m log n. All right. What kind? Many of the other speakers will talk about this problem in additional detail to satisfy your thirst for knowledge. But I'm just trying to give a brief overview right now. So, what kind of measurements? So the idea is to use randomness. See, the trouble is you don't know where those n non-zero entries are. And the worst thing you might have to do is go looking for them by checking every component of the signal. So instead, what you're going to do is create a set of summary statistics by randomly combining the entries of the vector. So roughly speaking, a sum of the entries in the vector with random weights is a maximally informative statistic. Slap a random sign onto each entry, add the entries up, you get one number. It turns out that measurement carries a lot of information about where the zeros and non-zeros in that vector are and what their values are. Not obvious, but it's true. And if you do that enough times, the number of times over 10 on the far board, you can actually identify the vector.
Plus or minus one.
For example, more normal weights, so it doesn't actually matter that much. So I'm going to talk about a specific class of measurements you can take. So we've just sort of abstracted the properties. So we have a class of what we call admissible measurement matrices. This is going to sort of quantify the properties that we need out of these random measurements. So there are four properties. The first one, M0, is an independence condition. So we require that the columns, not the rows, of phi be stochastically independent. So in other words, they're random variables that are independent from each other. Yep. Second, we have a normalization condition. This is inessential. It's just to make sure all the numbers work out right. So we assume that the expected squared norm of each column of the matrix equals 1. And that's true for all of the columns. Second condition. Joint correlation. So this is a little bit more complicated. So we're going to let ut, or t equals 1 to m, be vectors with norms less than or equal to 1.
Okay, so we've just got some collection of vectors. Their norms are small.
And we'll let phi be a column
of phi
independent from the sequence ut. Then we need the probability that the maximum inner product between this vector phi and ut being larger than epsilon, or sorry, being smaller than epsilon is very high. So this is sort of a substitute for coherence. Let me try to explain what this means, since it's a little bit complicated. Basically, it tells you you've got some sequence of vectors. These are basically the residuals that occur during the algorithm. Okay? You want to make sure that the inner product between some column of the matrix that's not dependent on those vectors be small with high probability. And this just happens to be the right normalization for a lot of cases. So with high probability, some column of this matrix isn't correlated with a sequence of vectors. Okay? And that basically ensures that you don't pick bad columns of the matrix during the algorithm. These things are closely related to the residuals that occur during the algorithm.
So what's the symbol at the beginning of that algorithm?
Oh, which line? Oh, that's the probability of a set. The bold P is a probability operator.
So that's not any set of vectors, that's particular ones that you generate during the
roughly.
I just assume that they're arbitrary, but it turns out that in the proof, they're the ones that occur when you run the algorithm. Yeah.
So when you say stochastically dependent, this is, you have more columns than rows here, right? Because you could have two.
Yeah, that's right.
Rows.
You have a lot more columns.
Right. So what's the notion? What do you mean stochastically dependent?
I just mean independent random variables.
So nothing about the dot parts on the overlap is
it has nothing to do with like linear independence. It's these are random variables are independent. Yeah. And there's one more condition.
But so I thought you fixed the basis, like the Hadamard basis, the Dirac or something basis.
No. This is just starting to erase it, but
okay.
If you take this matrix V of these measurement vectors that you're using to compute the inner products, you can dualize and look at the columns too. Okay, and so this is a random matrix. That's the idea here. So this measurement matrix phi, which consists of these rows or these columns, is a random matrix, and you want all of the columns here to be independent random vectors. Okay.
So you're doing the measurements iteratively or the reconstruction iteratively?
Not talking about either one of those things at this moment, but so you basically have this collection of linear functionals that you use to compute measurements of this unknown vector, and I'm not really talking about how you compute those measurements or where they come from or anything else, but you know the vectors that are used to perform the measurements. And you have the values of the measurements. Okay? So you've got that data at hand. I don't really care where it came from. Someone hands that to me, which, so I have a vector of measurement, and I have a matrix here that tells me where those measurements came from. And then I'm saying that you can use this greedy algorithm to solve that sparse representation problem and try and identify the vector x. So now I'm talking about a class of measurements that allow you to succeed at that.
Are you going
to
get the m sparse components all at once or iteratively? One at a time.
Well, with the greedy algorithm, we get them one at a time. So
anyone random? If I already found M minus one of them, why am I still doing random?
So someone hands you the... You're acting like this is an adaptive process, and it's not. Someone hands you all of these measurements, and you've got to do with them what you can to identify the vector x. So one way you can do that is to solve the sparse representation problem, and one algorithm for doing that is orthogonal matching pursuit. So that's roughly the answer. And then the algorithm spits out an estimate for the vector that you started with, the one that you're trying to find, based on the measurement data that it received. So that's sort of the overview again. And right now, I'm just describing a class of these random measurements that allow you to do this. Some of the technical details really only come in the proof, which we're not going to discuss.
Is the Wiggins function a sure event? Is the Wiggins function
going to be a sure event? I'm going to give you a theorem about that. But that's what you want to know. You want to reconstruct the vector. You've got some algorithm for doing it. The question is, does the algorithm work? So I'll come to that in a minute. But that's the right question to ask. Yeah.
Would maybe a different measure, or instead of like the L, maybe norm of the mutual coherence of atoms in your dictionary, would a different measurement that might be useful be like a
Using the deterministic stuff, you can't really improve on the result that I stated before. So those results are actually sharp, the deterministic ones for orthogonal matching pursuit. And if you want to get into the situation where you've got this random matrix, you need different tools. And the results are true for a somewhat different reason, roughly. All right, so let me write down the other properties you need these measurements to have, and then let me give you the examples that I'm interested in. So there's a least singular value property. So given a D by M submatrix Z of the measurement matrix, the nth largest singular value satisfies following probability bound. So here's the singular value. The probability that it's bigger than 1/2 ought to be very large. So 1 minus e to the minus c times d. All right. So these are properties that are relevant for the performance of orthogonal matching pursuit with random measurements. The key examples are the entries of the measurement matrix are independent and identically distributed, and they equal plus or minus 1 divided by the square root of the number of measurements with equal probability. No, I mean it this way. Yeah, you want to be well conditioned with high probability.
Which submatrix?
Any submatrix. Any one fixed submatrix.
One fixed.
Yeah, one fixed submatrix should have this property.
So you have this. You have phi, and it's true that if I choose adversarially some submatrix Z, it'll satisfy this.
No, if you say I get to select a collection of columns from phi, and then I draw phi after you tell me which columns at random, then it works like this.
Okay.
true adversarial in.
So just to be clear, you're saying that there has to exist a submatrix that satisfies this, or any?
No, any one that's specified in advance of the random choices. I think perhaps it was an error of judgment for me to present these properties here. Let's look at two specific examples. I was going to give you a proof, but we are far too short on time, and these are ideas are important in the proof. So the key examples of measurement matrices that satisfy these properties are: if you flip a coin for each entry, if it comes up heads, you make it 1 over root d. If it comes up tails, you make it minus 1 over root d. Okay? Or the entries are IID Gaussian with mean 0 and variance 1 over d. And so that has a PDF of 1 over root 2 pi s e to the minus s squared d over 2. Oops, I should have a d. Okay, so basically you can make the entries Gaussian independent. You can make them plus minus 1 independent. Doesn't matter. Okay? So, if you come back here and you say, well, we're going to take measurements by randomly weighting the entries of the vector and adding them up, the first case says put a random sign on each entry, add them up. Do that a few times. The second case there says multiply each entry of the vector by a Gaussian random variable, add them up. Okay, we do that a number of times to collect several measurements. Okay. And so what happens in this setting? So both of these measurement matrices here have high coherence. So Bernoullian Gaussian measurement matrices. So these are the two examples here. Have coherence that looks something like the square root of log n over d. So if there are two measurements, this is the size of the coherence statistic. Okay. And so the result that I proved before says that we need something like m squared times log n measurements. And so you can see that the dependence here on n is quadratic rather than linear, as we expect that it ought to be. So it's bad news. And so the coherence result doesn't tell you what you want. And it turns out you can do much, much better. So here's a theorem due to myself and Gilbert that tells you what orthogonal matching pursuit actually does in this setting. So fix a failure probability that's smallish and choose a number of measurements d that's bigger than a constant times m times the log of the signal length divided by the failure probability. Okay? So number of measurements is proportional to m and logarithmic in n, instead of being quadratic in n and logarithmic in n as it was here. Okay? And we'll let x be an n sparse vector in Rn. So, high-dimensional space, sparse vector. We draw an admissible matrix independent from
result says that given the measurement data, so we multiply X into the measurement matrix, you get this small collection of linear measurements, OMP recovers X perfectly. With probability at least 1 minus delta. So, if you want to make sure that you solve this problem with 99% certainty, this theorem tells you that you can do that. Collect this number of linear measurements of the signal at random, this random measurement process. Collect the random measurements, you run orthogonal matching pursuit, and orthogonal matching pursuit gives you the original vector with the probability that you demand.
Yeah. Sorry, you guys have a question, but you find orthogonal matching pursuit where you use the delta basis as the, what do you use as your?
You use this matrix V, the measurement matrix, as the dictionary. Okay? That's why I'm using the same letter. No. You can actually tell when the algorithm fails in both of those cases. So, and in Gaussian cases, that's a zero probability event, actually. I'm sorry. After m steps, so what I mean is that after m steps, the error is zero if you have succeeded, and it's not zero if you have failed, and that's true with probability.
Sorry, it's the same, roughly the same question. So what you knew was that it was sparse in the delta basis, and you're saying you only need m of the random, so it's actually sparse in that one as well.
So yeah, you have this dictionary here. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, when you set the problem up, you can see that x is sparse, this is some random matrix, you have this vector y that's input to the algorithm, okay? And so y is sparsely represented in the columns of phi, the random matrix. And which columns participate in y tells you where x is non-zero and the coefficients. So that's sort of how that works. That's how you find y, the pitch.
Yeah, I just want to clarify. So when you say you're drawing this divisible matrix independent from x, you're not saying that x has to be random. You're just saying that for every x, you have to draw a different phi.
That's right. X.
So there's not one
yeah,
phi that works for all.
That's right. X is generic. You can choose whatever x you like, but phi cannot depend on x. That's an important difference with the L1. So.
So you have a bunch of x's for which there's, you know, some probability distribution. Is there where you can tune the phi?
Yeah, actually, there's not much known about the case where X is random. And I want to write down one more sort of rule of thumb here. For 99% success probability, you need the number of measurements to be greater than about 2 times m times log n. Okay, so the constant there is small. So for 99% success, the constant's like 2. Okay. The proof gives you something a little bit worse, not much. But at any rate, so in summary, you've got this greedy algorithm for sparse representation and sparse approximation problems. It can always find the sparsest representation of a vector if that representation is sparse enough. It can also solve this compressed sensing problem where you take random measurements of the sparse vector and you want to recover the vector. And it can do that provided that the number of measurements is a little bit bigger than the sparsity level and logarithmic in the length of that unknown vector you're trying to identify. And so this algorithm is actually reasonably effective in a variety of settings of sparse approximation.
If n goes to n,
we'll talk a little bit more about this. I can say it sort of, well, it depends on the regime, the parameters, and how you take the limits. Yes.
What happens when it fails? Like, are you guaranteed that it will be the smallest component that will not?
No, all you know is it was choked and died, and your cry. And,
okay, so when it fails, it fails miserably.
Huh?
When it fails miserably.
It could, yeah.
Okay.
Not necessarily. In fact, for compressed sensing, it's actually pretty good. So typically for a compressed sensing problem, what you would actually want to do is run it for more than m steps. You run it for 2m steps, or run it for d steps, where d is the number of measurements. And that actually gives you better answers for practical purposes. This is a theorem, you know? And, you know, it gives you some insight, but it doesn't necessarily tell you what to do with practice.
You mean it corrects itself?
Yeah, that's right.
So here's the thing. Maybe it makes a mistake, maybe it makes 10 mistakes, but if it eventually picks all the right stuff, it'll still give you a perfect representation of the vector that you started with. So that's sort of the idea.